This is the G Podcast, where we focus on family, friends, finances, freedom, and our future, and everything else. This is the G Podcast, and today we got a special guest, comedian, straight out of Wilmington, North Carolina. We got Louis T in the building, and we getting right to it. Yes, indeed, y'all. One more time. This is the G Podcast, where we focus on family, friends, finances, freedom, and our future, and everything else. Louis T, thank you so much for joining.
Hey, thank you for having me, man. I'm glad to be here.
Word up. So, man, we're going to get right into the conversation, man. I know you're based out of Wilmington. Where are you actually from?
I was born in Fayetteville, but I mean, I've been in Wilmington, I went to school, I grew up in Wilmington, so I claim Wilmington.
Okay. And so, are your folks from North Carolina? Were they in the military? Like, what took you from Fayetteville over to Wilmington?
So I was in the military, but no, neither one of my folks was. My dad is, and his family's from Fayetteville. My mom's side of the family is pretty much from the Wilmington area. My mom went to Fayetteville State, and I met my dad at Fayetteville State. But when they split, mom came back to Wilmington.
Okay. And growing up in a town like Wilmington, me being from Durham, I remember just reading about Wilmington. There's something that took place. I forget what year it was, but I believe it was like the 1800s.
1898.
Yeah. So let's actually just talk about that. You seem to know exactly what I'm talking about. 1898. Can you tell me what took place in 1898?
So I call it was a massacre. It's the only successful coup d'etat in the nation. So, I mean, so you got similar things like Tulsa, Rosewood, where pretty much the white people of that time kind of like took over and overthrew the government. The difference is in Wilmington, where other places, they overthrew the government, but when it came back time for a re-election or whatever, it kind of got back, reset back to normal. That never happened in Wilmington. Like, nobody came back and reset it. Like, and some of those things are still, you know, people feel like you still see a lot of those results still to the day. Like, Wilmington had a prospering black community. It was like, you know, it was like a big, like a nice, well, middle class and, you know, upper middle class. And they had people in government, and they had people, even the white people that was in government, supported blacks. Because back then, it was it's almost reversed, but it was like the Republicans.
With the black party.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like the Republicans was in charge, and the Democratic Party kind of came and got them up out of there.
And they didn't just get them up out of there by asking them to leave. Like they burned buildings, like looted, like they really destroyed properties, did quite a bit to overthrow what was in place at that time in Wilmington.
Oh, yeah. Like it started with well, it was a bunch of things, but Andrew, I can't think of it, man. The guy that ran a newspaper, a black newspaper, he ran an article that went against an article that a white woman had out talking about how women were getting harassed out in the fields because they were working side by side with people of color. Mm. And so there was a woman that had an article saying, hey, you got us out here with these people and they're raping us, blah, blah, blah. And God, it's on the tip of my tongue. I want to say Manly. I think it's Andrew. But anyway, he ran a paper and he ran an article saying that this ain't really what's going on. A lot of these women not only are not getting raped, they enjoy or are the aggressor in some of these situations. So it was already kind of a tense thing. And now this is just my interpretation of the events, but there are people not from Wilmington that had money, kind of came in here, aggravated the people that didn't have money. They used that article and some other things to kind of instigate things and just kind of went from there. Another big instigator of it was Alexander's rival, which is the Star News, which is still in place in Wilmington today. So the guy that ran the Star News definitely had beef because the black newspaper was selling more papers than he was. And so I mean, I feel like it's kind of similar to politics today. You know, the haves kind of like instigate the have-nots to be the front of their war, where, you know, it's really not about race. It's about money.
Yeah. I would agree that race is a mask to put over the real thing at play here, and that's, you know, whether it be money, power, access to resources, like it all to me goes under the same sort of umbrella. But like growing up in Durham, traditionally Durham is known as a black city.
Black Wall Street
precisely, right? And outside of Durham, even like in Raleigh or Chapel Hill, I would say growing up, these were more conservative pockets, even though the universities and things, as a black person growing up, I didn't really have instances inside of Durham where I felt like I got discriminated against cops, but I did feel like I got pulled randomly in Wake County and Orange County. And I'm curious for you growing up in Wilmington, you know, given the background of what took place there, I'm sure there are folks, maybe not today, but when you were growing up, maybe even some today, let me not go too far, but when you were growing up, I'm sure there were folks who remembered or had parents or somebody close, you know, that were directly impacted by those events that took place in Wilmington. And I've always seen it as a more conservative, don't get caught in the wrong part of town type of city from the outside in. Is that fair to say that it's kind of one of those, you stay on your side of the tracks, we stay on our side, or is it friendly and integrated growing up? What do you say the temperature's like there?
I mean, it was definitely, especially compared to now, it was definitely more segregated. But I mean, I think people talk about segregation like it's bad. Mm-hmm. But being that it was segregated, I never, you know, especially young, you can really get around, because I kind of grew out of the city. You know, I grew up actually not too far from where Michael Jordan grew up. But that was kind of, I don't think of it as a country, but I think further out as a country, but people in the city might would consider it kind of the country. And now it's not, you know what I mean? Like, because it was like right on that verge, and now that the city's grown, it definitely probably wouldn't be considered a country now. But when I grew up there, I could see some people consider it the country. But I am aware of, like, I didn't experience it, but I'm aware of certain areas, like towards Carolina Beach, like Carolina Beach Road, where there were some areas where the Klan were like dominant at, you know what I mean? And I've heard stories. But luckily, you know, I mean, I grew up at the time, a black neighborhood. So I just grew up around black people. I went to school with white people. But
which high school in Wilmington did you go to?
Laney, E.A. Laney.
Okay, so you went to Laney, the school that Jordan put on the map.
Yes.
Word. Do they really, like, I mean, as a student there, how big is his presence within the walls of the school? Do they have him plastered everywhere? Is it Jordan everything?
He's plastered, like, in, I think right after I left or when I was leaving, because I've seen him a couple times. Like, he came there, he used to give we might still do give the basketball team shoes.
Oh, word.
He's, you know, like now the gymnasium is now named after him. Like, it's a Jordan gymnasium, like the Jordan brand gymnasium. But it wasn't like that when I went to school. But now, so his presence is definitely felt in that school.
Oh, that's nice that he's giving some resources back to that part of the community.
Mm-hmm. And like, I think they did like a big event or something when they first switched it over and redid the floors and like, I guess, christened it the Jordan Gymnasium.
Word. How would you describe your experience at Laney?
Interesting. Like, because I went to Laney during, like, during a lot of shifts. So I went to Laney during the riots. And that was an interesting time. Like, a lot of things that's in play now, I feel like was the start of when I was there. Like, when I went, like, my first couple of years at Laney, there wasn't like a police presence. But then after that, there's like a sheriff presence, which I believe all schools now have to the day, but before then there was no like police presence. It was definitely interesting. Like I remember being in a home ec class and we're all just chilling. And one of the teachers was just felt comfortable enough to say, like, talking about the Rodney King thing and, like, how, not verbatim, but, like, pretty much how she didn't have, she had more empathy for the police than Rodney King. And that was one of the first things, like, you know, like, it, you know, but it was fun. Like I said, nobody, like, when that's all you know, that's all you know. So you don't know. You know, like I said, you don't know because that's all you know. That's what I grew up with. And especially back then, the world was small. It was, you know, it was kind of pre-internet.
And when you were in school, say at those early ages, were you a class clown? Were you telling jokes? Like what?
No, I mean, a little bit. I've probably always been a little bit of a smart ass, but I don't think I was necessarily the class clown. I was always just like laid back, you know what I mean? Probably, you know, no waves, no, you know, no ripples, just kind of dealt with who I dealt with, in the hip hop. Okay. I can't even say music. I was just in the hip hop and a little bit in the comic books, that kind of thing. So I just kind of just stuck to my own kind of thing.
Okay.
You know, because I would say I was always like, because I mean, back then nerd wasn't cool. So I was always just trying to be cool enough not to be a nerd. You know what I mean? But not necessarily like cool. You know what I mean? Like,
and so at that moment, given where you are today, what you're doing today was not something that you had in mind, say, growing up, thinking that I want to perform, or maybe not say specifically perform, but on a comedy element. Did you want to perform in other ways? Were you in, like, theater, or did you rap yourself back in those days? Like, I'm curious, did you have any artistic expression going on at that time period?
No. Comedy is my first time actually being the art. Growing up, my art was, or talent was, being able to find talent. Like, I've always been like the mediator between the business world and the artistic world. Mm-hmm. So it's like I could speak to both worlds because I understood and appreciated art, but not necessarily produced the art per se. Mm-hmm. So like in comedy, I never had ambitions of being like a comedian. I mean, I always liked comedy, but that didn't seem like anything real to me. So like, I would have believed I would have been a rapper before ever being a comedian. And I can't rap.
And you say it didn't seem real. Is that because, or why do you feel like it just was not even something that seemed realistic growing up in Wilmington?
You didn't see anybody. I don't know any comedians, you know, from here. Like, it's one of those things, like, you see people like Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, but when I was growing up, they were already Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor. You had Def Comedy Jam, that was big, and you're seeing those people, but all those people kind of like were like celebrities. Like, even, you know, and the people that was on Def Comedy Jam that wasn't celebrities, they became celebrities. So, I mean, it's just like kind of, I guess some people are like that. It's like just saying, I want to be an actor. And, you know, like, there's no actors from Wilmington, but now they are. There are actors, and there's a big
like studio set up somewhere down. They shoot a lot of movies and TV shows out that way, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Was it Dawson's Creek back in the day that was shot out that way?
Dawson's Creek, One Tree Hill.
One Tree Hill, yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, and so when that's starting to happen, like, is it easy as a local to tap into those sort of opportunities to work on a set, to get exposed to any of those just jobs or roles that might can get you, you know, in that world of TV or film and production?
From my understanding, you can get on as an extra, but getting on as an extra is not a career. You're not going to get your SAG card necessarily from that. You know, it's one of those, you know, you have that lottery chance of being in the right place, right time, impressing the right person, and maybe something happened. But that's, you know, I say that's lottery. You know what I mean? That's not like, that's not, I mean, people feel that way, but you can use it if you're a hustler. And I kind of wish I had those ambitions. I never had ambitions of being, I never saw myself as an actor, because I feel like with my know-how and grind, I might have been able to make things happen. But, you know, I mean, I know a lot of people that's going their route. Some of those people took what they learned and now doing stuff for themselves, because now with technology, you might not need a studio or you don't need as many resources to get a project across the finish line. But it's just being, you know, just being in Dawson's Creek would be the music equivalent of, you know, being on a mixtape with track 23 or to 30. You know what I mean? It's not like, yeah, I'm there, but how many people are listening?
Yeah, that's I kind of forgot about that, but I do thinking back, remember hearing about how there were movies and shows being shot out that way in North Carolina. And I didn't think that was kind of dope that we had something like that in the state. Like, did you do much? Because I talked to a guy on an episode. His name is George. He went to UNC Wilmington. He calls it UNC White. But, you know, he went to Hillside in Durham, went out to Wilmington, and that was a culture shock for him, you know, going out there. When you finished high school, did you leave Wilmington? Did you stay in Wilmington? What was kind of next after that for you?
I stayed in Wilmington. I joined the National Guard my senior year of high school. So, I mean, I kind of left for that, like, my junior going into my senior year. So after my senior year, I went down to Columbia, Fort Jackson for basic training. And then I went to Fort Lee, Virginia for my AIT training. But I mean, it was National Guard. So once I was done with that, I came back to Wilmington because we did our 1 week in a month. And then like in the summer, we did 2 weeks in the summer. And typically we'd either go to Fort Bragg or sometimes I went to a base in Alabama, Mississippi, that kind of thing. But I went to community college. I didn't like leave, I didn't have the aspirations of, I like Wilmington. I mean, but again, I guess it was one of those things that's what I knew. So it was like, I didn't, some people, I mean, but there was a lot of people, you know, there was a big exodus to like Atlanta or just the HBCUs. So, I mean, I know there was like other experience, people that experienced things maybe different than me that forced them to leave, but I never had that urge. Like, I probably have more of an urge to leave now than like when I was younger.
Yeah, I talked about that on some prior episodes of just what exposure can do to the brain, and then because you've never seen it, you can't even imagine it. But then once you start seeing all types of things, you start imagining like, well, if that can happen, then what about this? Then what about that? And the brain starts going once you start getting exposed to different things. So like when you were trying to finish up school, did you have like an idea of what you say wanted to do as a professional at that period, or like what was your thoughts in terms of like, how am I gonna make some bread?
So I mean, high school just messed me up. I was in this marketing class, and I felt like it put me on the path that I originally started on. So
you said it messed you up.
Well, I mean, it's just like, it ain't messed me up, but it's like, and I mean, also parent influence. Cause I wanted to be in I was ironically telling the story last night, but I grew up and I wanted to be in marketing because there was a show called Who's the Boss. Mm-hmm. And the lead character was in. I was like, and then my mom told me that you can't do marketing, because back then I think they just kind of like marketing and advertising was the same thing. And she said you can't draw, you know, like that, you know. But anyway, so I took marketing classes. So in my marketing class, my teacher was like, you're male, you're black, you will stand out to be a nurse. If you were the nurse, and they was like, yo. Back, you know, they start off like $20-something an hour. So I was like, man, you know, you could go to school, do the 2-year thing. I was like, well, I could do this, and then I could just always want to work for myself. You know, I was like, I feel like that's where what I wanted to do. And I was like, but if I was like, I can do this, get some bread, and then invest in myself. You know, like even when I was young, like I remember talking to mom, like, I wanted to do a food truck before, like this was before food trucks were so popular. Mm-hmm. And I remember being in the military and they had these things called roach coaches, which were essentially food trucks. But the problem was, especially back then, I think it's still a little bit this way now, there's so many laws that kind of keep you out. You had to have a kitchen. So I was like, well, I mean, I'm going to just sell I'll just try to do stuff that you would have to cook, like microwavable foods and all that kind of thing. But it was just such an investment, and there was no blueprint at that time. So it's just like, I never pulled a trigger on it. You know what I mean? Like, but anyway, I originally was going to school to be a nurse, because my thing was, if I'm a nurse, make that $20+ an hour, stand out, be a male nurse, I can write my own ticket. And then I don't need $22 to survive on, so I could put away some bread and figure out what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. And is that what you ended up doing?
No. So I started going to school. I was in a business class. So I was still taking like my electives of business class. And there was some project, and I wanted, like, in high school, me and my friends used to throw parties. Like, we used to rent out a hotel and just have parties, like hotel parties. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man,
you're talking about in a room where you knew you was gonna get kicked out by a certain time, like
okay. Well, yeah, most of the times we did, but sometimes we didn't. Yeah.
I remember that era where you get a room and you just try and get it lit for as long as possible. Hopefully somebody on the floor is looking out.
So I didn't know anything about clubs. Then I found out about clubs. I was like, why don't we just do parties here? Like, you know what I mean? Like, and then it just, and then I met one late night. I met my man, H. Nice, rest in peace. And he was doing a college night on Wednesdays, but he wasn't the guy. It was like, you know, you always have the spot that's popping, and you got the spot that's want to be popping. Mm-hmm. So I helped him get popping. You know, he wasn't the popping spot, but if either you got kicked out the other spot or you just didn't like the other spot, we were the B spot. Like, we were the go bot. So I helped him with that. And then, so I got in with the owner, the manager at the spot. It was called Oasis. And I put together a rap battle. And then from there, I kind of left school alone and just started, I met some people that influenced my, you know, where I went to the day. Like, I met this dude named Fuzz Jackson. He was in a group called NHA. There were some people that I knew at the time that I can't even remember their name now, because I was just like, knew they were gonna body this MC battle. You know, I put up some bread and then from there, I had a meeting with Fuzz and some of his people, and then some of my people's people. Like, there's this dude named Ron Key I went to high school with. Him and a guy named Red, they were like kind of like the star, you know, like the up and coming stars or whatever, because they opened up for like Wu-Tang, Outkast, all the local shows, the big ones they opened up for. So my man Ron Key said, yo, link up with Red. Red at the time just moved back from Atlanta. So he's one of the people that left, but he ended up coming back because of some family stuff. I linked Red up with Fuzz, and at the time he was in a collective called NHA, and I just started booking shows. I had no idea what to do in booking and promoting shows.
For those folks.
Yeah.
So you're like
there, it just kind of grew.
Tour manager kind of thing, or a show manager, or like somewhat kinda, of a manager,
I mean,
kind of.
Yeah, because I wouldn't really manage it. Like, I would, some people are more hands-on with, like NHA, like Fuzz and them, they kind of already had their own thing going. But what I was doing, Fuzz, NHA, that was more of like the backpacker, you know, very, a lot of white following, you know, mm-hmm. which is representative of Wilmington, especially downtown Wilmington, where a lot of stuff happened. and Red, he was one of the precursors to a lot of like Southern hip hop now. But they like, so Red was very North Carolina. It wasn't quite all the way South, but definitely was where NHA had that definitely had that New York influence. You know, a couple of them was from Georgia, but they were from Augusta. They weren't from like Atlanta. So, and other ones were from like North Carolina, but they were more, you know, they were more Little Brother, or what Little Brother would have been, than Petey Pablo.
Mm-hmm. I feel what you're saying. I feel exactly. I like how you worded that, because like how you said, North Carolina, if you're not from here and you just know those like stereotypical rural pockets, it might get looked at as like a, you know, a country South type of environment. Don't get me wrong. A lot of the state, you will find that. Like, do not get me wrong.
Those dirt roads.
Yeah. And they're all around. Even just, you know, you go a couple miles east, west, north of Durham, you're going to run into some of these like conservative, say, what we call country pockets. There's a culture here. I don't, you know, whether it be because people come down here from up north or whatever the case, but we are heavily influenced, especially the music, especially like in Durham, like you mentioned, the Little Brother versus the Petey Pablo. Like, you could tell Little Brother's influences, a lot of that is from the Northeast, just the,
yeah,
especially the Knife Wonder sound, the boom bap, the soul samples that like that kind of took North Carolina bigger than what it was. Like, to me, Little Brother, you know, respect to Petey Pablo, but Little Brother to me is the pinnacle of North Carolina rap to me. Like, they're the oomph. Like, and then after that, you had Cole, who come to be like the, you know, he's not even, I can't even classify, like, he's just his own thing. He's so big. Yeah. Pause. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Cole is just like a mega star. He's beyond just a hip hop star. So he took North Carolina rap, but he got known in Queens, going to St. John's and being up in New York and stuff like that. So I like how you put it. It's like we're not quite super South, but that Southern influence is always clearly there in the culture and the tones.
Yeah, definitely. But you got both. Like, you got the Fontes, but you definitely got the Petey's. You know what I mean?
No,
like, both
question.
Of them are representative of North Carolina. Like, neither one, you know.
No question. Yeah, I think the state is underrated for lyricism, I think, is my take, is what I'm trying to say. Whereas, like, you know how they say, like, in the South, it's not lyrics, but I think North Carolinian artists in hip hop, lyrics are typically more at the forefront. And that, I think that holds true when you look at a Cole, Little Brother, Baby, out of Charlotte too. Like, he's mad lyrical, and he can boogie. So I feel like those who make it out of the state and make their names, that they definitely are, lyrics are more at the forefront of what they present.
Yeah. Or like from Durham, Jay Gunn. Like,
of course, you know, of course.
There's definitely some spitters. And I mean, that so many, like Kazi, I know he's doing his acting thing, but he's coming back with some music. You had Splash. There was a lot of, there's definitely some people, but I think, I don't know if that hurts or helps. Like, you know what I mean? Because it might be too similar to others, because North Carolina don't necessarily have a sound. I don't know if that's why people like Petey might have transcended, you know, where others haven't. Because, you know, there's nothing to say, like, this person, you can't really know where they're from. Like Skills, I don't know if you know Skills from, I mean, he actually was born in North Carolina, but from Virginia. In the 90s, he had an album where he's just rapping. And he's like, yo, where you from, Queens? And he's like, no, you from Brooklyn. He's like, you know, and he's like, I'm from Virginia. And he's like, from where, you know what I mean? Because he don't sound, you know what I mean? He has that New York sound.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, so I don't know. And I mean, I'm just rambling, like, but I don't know if that helps or hurt, because it's not what people think of when you think of North Carolina.
Now, I feel that it's the difference that Atlanta might have, or Houston might have, where, you know, sonically, each one of those towns, even though it's South, like, Atlanta has had multiple sounds over time that they've spread through hip hop. And then that Houston sound too, it's like undeniably a sound that comes out of Houston, a sound that comes out of Atlanta, Whereas I don't know, yeah, if we really got that sound that come out of North Carolina.
Yeah, because even the baby, I would say like the baby would be a Petey Pablo child, where J. Cole would be a little brother child. But the baby don't sound like Petey. You know what I mean? Like
the baby, man. Yeah, he does do the commercial. He gets down with the, you know, the more like fun type of music, but I think he gets in his introspective bag too. That's why
that's his lyrical content, pocket too. Yeah. But like 21 Savage, he has different content. Like he can, you know, but his sound is still that Atlanta sound. It's like, no matter what you say, it's kind of, I'm not talking about necessarily what you say, it's kind of how you're saying it.
Yeah, I feel what you're saying.
You know what I mean? And I mean, like, the baby, you know, he has that Southern drawl, and it's not overly Southern. Like, I feel like the baby probably more so than Petey. I feel like the baby's somewhere in between, like, a Petey, J. Cole, little brother.
Yeah,
Southern, necessarily country. You know what I mean? Like, a little country. Well, like, just a little. You know what I mean? Like, so that, like, he's a good representation of probably, like, a North Carolina sound.
I would agree. And he definitely did have his own sound with at the beginning too. Like, you knew it was a baby song as soon as the beat dropped. Like, you knew it was who was going to be on that joint. Mm-hmm. And so growing up, being influenced by hip hop, getting into the local scene, I guess at what point did you pick up a mic and want to get in front of people and start performing yourself? And it's not even necessarily comedy, but just in general, like, at what point you say, you know what, I don't want to be behind the curtain. I'm trying to produce something on my own. You know what I'm saying? Go out there and showcase what I have as an artist.
I never necessarily wanted to do it. I was fine being behind the curtain until it made more sense financially and, you know, for me to be in front. Like, it's business first. You know, so it didn't, if it makes sense, if it don't make sense, it don't make dollars. So, I mean, there was times when I was hosting or putting together hip hop shows, and it made more sense for if the show required a host, it made more sense for me to host, because chances are whoever I pay to do it is not going to do it as well as I would want them to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then other people, had paid me to host their events, like, you know, because they saw me run, like, you know, they saw me produce my own shows. They're like, oh, yo, just to have my name attached to it, they would get me. So with the comedy, I was producing variety shows. Like with that's how I got into comedy. I was done producing. Like I did produce music shows, mostly hip hop, for over a decade. You know, and like I was done with it for almost a decade. Like I was, you know, burnt out, tired of dealing with rappers, tired of dealing with egos. I met with someone, they were doing comedy. I was like, yeah, let's, I had a concept that I liked, and it was just like, I wanted to develop it. I was like, let's do a variety show. So did mix comedy with music, and then being exposed, like comedy was something that was always ran parallel with me. Like, one of the venues I used to do hip hop shows at, or shows in general, was a spot called Soapbox.
Mm.
At the bottom of Soapbox, there was this comedy club called Nut Street. Like, it was kind of part of it, but separate. So every now and then I would check out bigger comedy acts. Like I saw Neil Brennan, who's Chappelle's partner. Mm-hmm. And I saw him. I saw, I always forget his real name, but Leon Phelps, the ladies' man. I saw him down
Leon
there.
Leon Phelps.
Yeah. So, but all these people I'm familiar with. And then I remember seeing actually somebody I actually know now, but it was this dude named Matt White. And he was living in Wilmington. He's actually in the Raleigh area. I was like, yeah, yo, that dude is funny. So that was the first time I saw somebody not famous, that he was so funny, I thought he could be famous. And I found, oh, like, yo, he's from where? Here. So I remember seeing him, he was one of the openers. I thought, oh, man, you know, because usually a lot of times the openers are not funny or not as funny.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still, I never paid much attention to it because I was focused on music. But it was there, like comedy was there. And then a lot of the people, and then Soapbox closed, Nut Street became Dead Crow, and it moved. But a lot of the people from Soapbox worked at Dead Crow. So I still had a relationship. I did a couple events, non-comedy events there, and it just kind of, you saw it, and like some people, like I knew of some people, and so it just always been there. And then flash forward to me producing a comedy music show, and we was doing it at Dead Crow. They moved to a new location, and then from there, checking out comedians, I started going to open mics. I used to all hear about open mic, but I never went at Nut Street or Dead Crow, which I wish I was, because like it's like if you said that you from Nut Street or the old Dead Crow, it's like almost like a stamp, like, you know, mm-hmm. like you're an OG. Mm-hmm. I was like, I was there, but I wasn't there. So I start going to these open mics to check out comedians. It's always been, or for a long time, it was one of those just things I want to check off and to do do open mic, because it's one of those things where I'm conversationally funny. So my friends think I'm funny. Do other people think I'm funny? Mm-hmm. I went to open mic, had no aspirations. I just wanted to try it. Did it, went well. And it's just one of those things where I kept going. And then I did one of the events, my partner said, well, you should host. I'm like, no, I'm not ready. I want to still give this opportunity to somebody else. But it's like in my head. And then I started hosting events, my comedy, you know, and with comedy, the hosts typically do some comedy up front, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, and then, you know, start bringing other people up. So that was kind of my introduction. And I went from just hosting, and then people wanted to be on my show. So people start asking me to be on their show. So I put them on my show. And then that just kind of started me performing comedy for other people. And it just kind of went on, but it just made more sense. People knew me. I had a name and I had a rep. So once I felt confident in my own abilities, I know, you know, it would be easier for me to get people there if I knew I was in front of it. Like, people knew that I put together a good show, so my name carried weight there. But it's like, okay, you know, it's a good show. But it's like, nah, not only is it a good show, I'm going to be there, so you're going to be seeing me. So I felt like it would be easier for me to get people there based on, like, I guess my popularity or notoriety from stuff I've already done.
And so doing an open mic, did you go up there and just improv it? Did you prep those jokes? Did you write them out? Like, what was the, how did you prep the material before that open mic where you gave it your first shot?
No, I kind of knew what I wanted to say. I wrote it. I kind of try to practice it a little bit. I'm not an improver. I knew what I wanted to say, and it was probably maybe 2 or 3 minutes. It's funny, like the joke I did my very first open mic, I just got to a point where I said, man, I'm not going to tell that. Like, I've been telling a version of that joke ever since. You know what I mean? I made it better, but I feel like I just kind of retired that joke, at least locally. Like, if I got to go out of town and I got to do a certain amount of time, I'm going to pull it out the tub, you know, to do my time. But I just got to the point where I was like, I don't really need to, you know, I feel like it's not as funny, but I feel like it's probably me because I've said that joke so many times where I probably don't even deliver it the same oomph that I used to. But yeah, I definitely wrote it down. Yeah, I definitely wrote it down and tried to practice it.
And like, when you're writing it, you don't have any help on your first sort of go around. You're just kind of doing what you think was best to prep for the set, if you will. You're not following no frameworks, looking at YouTube or anything like that. You just kind of doing what you think you need to do.
Yeah. I mean, like, people still try to like teach. There's people that teach comedy classes. There's people that try to tell me this and that. And I have no, like, I had and have no training ever. Yeah, it's just like, I think this is funny. And then as I do it, I'll tell it better. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like, work on the word economy, like, cut down unnecessary words. And that sometimes some people be like, hey, you might want to say it like this versus that. You know, it's just, I still just go on, like, I've been watching comedy all these years and kind of based it on the whole thing that people always thought I was funny. So kind of just based it on that. And then, you know, like, so I'll go to an open mic to test it out or try it and just kind of see what worked. And then if not, go back to the drawing board.
And I know, like, just being on any stage as a live performer, it comes with nerves and it's, it's definitely just that in itself, getting in front of people and speaking can be challenging. And I know in an art form like comedy, you know, I would imagine it's even more challenging when you're up there and you're not getting the responses you hope for, right? Or you're not getting the feedback you want. Have you ever just bombed where it was just like, I can't believe this just happened here, like where it was a complete bomb, or you felt like you had to kind of get off the stage because it was going so bad?
No, I mean, knock on wood, I haven't done like anything like that. I was telling one of my friends, the closest thing I felt like I did a bomb. I performed for like a majority, like older black room. I was the host, and it's just like I felt like I just wasn't moving the needle. But even like the headliner, like we had this dude Brooklyn Mike, or Troy Mike from Brooklyn, and he was like, "It's just like a weird crowd." But I felt like they were entertained. They just wasn't vocal. You know, they weren't like...
Yeah, they weren't giving like, you the energy, like, yeah.
They weren't like trying to boo me, but they wasn't like, you know, and I was like, man, but I was still kind of new. And I was like, man, I would have did a completely different set and hopefully it would have went better. But it wasn't like, you know, like I still like, I got a couple followers, you know what I mean? So the people was feeling it, but it wasn't like, it was like crickets almost sometimes, you know what I mean? Like, and it was like, I don't think, you know, some of the stuff, the material I was doing, they, you know, it just wasn't for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that was my most, like, I don't feel like I bombed, like, or felt like, because I mean, I had to keep coming, I had to, you know, be, as a host, I kept coming back. That's the one thing where I felt like, man, you know, I could have done a lot better, you know.
So how long do you think it felt like it took you from that open mic to get to a point to where you actually felt like, I know what I'm doing?
So I started, like, that first open mic was in June, and I started hosting stuff in March. So, and I mean, it was supposed to be February. February was supposed to be, and then it was had some venue issues. So I guess, you know, it's about six months, you know, I felt comfortable at least to do my own stuff. Like I said, my first show that I produced that I was going to be on was supposed to be February. Something happened with the venue. And then March, I put together, I was hosting shows every Sunday for March. I put together different things. It was a little bit smaller than the show that I was doing originally. Because it was just like one music act, like maybe one or two comedians, and like I said, I host. Mm-hmm. And then by April, I had four shows that other people did, like me getting on other people's show. From April to May, it was like four shows. So, but by then I felt good. And then it was just like from there, it was all she wrote.
Word. And like you started doing stuff locally in Wilmington. What was your first opportunity outside of Wilmington?
I feel like the first show I did outside was Youngsville, North Carolina, outside of Wake Forest.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Youngsville? Is it Youngsville or Sneed's Ferry? But Sneed's Ferry is not that far out of Wilmington. And just through connections, like some people threw my name in the hat. I got the show in Youngsville. Actually, I headlined that show. So it was like I think it was like one of my first shows out of town, and I was like the closer, which was kind of.
And how, like, and at this point, how long is the set that you crafted?
That was like 15 minutes.
Okay.
That was like a 15 minute set.
What all goes into like prepping 15 minutes of a comedy set? Like, how long does it take to craft 15 minutes?
Well, I mean, it's not, you got to have that material. So it's like, typically it goes, you work on your 5 minutes. Sometimes like some of the open mics might be 3 minutes. You might not use all that 3 minutes. So, and it's just, it's literally like going to the gym and you're like working out, getting stronger. But then the one thing is like, I did up to like, roughly about a 25 plus minute set. Like I was doing 20s, and then it's like I stripped that 20 plus set down to 10 minutes. I got rid of this, like, you know, I'm not doing this, and then I'm building it back up, You know, because that's kind of just like, so I'm like back up to, I would say, I mean, of course I could do 20. I've done it. I would rather do 15. Depending on where it is, anything outside of Wilmington, I would rather just do 15 right now. But I'm building it up to where I have a solid 25 anywhere, you know, where anywhere. Mm-hmm. So you got to have that material or unless you can do, there's some people that just can do crowd work. Depending on how the venue set up, I don't want to like rely on that. So I want to be able to know that, hey, I got this material or this, so I can switch it up, switch some stuff up where it'll work, and I can give you this solid 20 minute kind of thing. But I want to, like I said, I'm trying to, because like some of my material is specialized, like, and that's why, that's why I stripped a lot of stuff away. Like I used to do like a lot of blurred nerd material. Like, and that's what I did that for that Black Room. They don't get necessarily those references. So like I'm trying to do stuff where it will work anywhere. You know what I mean? It'll work most places. But then I'm also trying to work on stuff that is specialized. Like, cause I would like to do, I work with CNS Comics and I want to do more conventions, more cons, and where I do have like more. So it's kind of that trying to find that between that line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel what you're saying. I remember I actually did a podcast with another comedian. Shout out to Quan Wiggins. He's from North Carolina, and now he's up in the New York City area doing comedy shows and things of that nature. And he mentioned something similar, just about he went to Central and he was doing comedy around Durham. And figuring out that just because I'm funny in front of my friends doesn't necessarily mean I'm be funny in this room of people versus this room of people. And then having to understand that like the jokes got to hit regardless of who's in the room and mm-hmm. come into that realization in real time. You mentioned the CNS element, like shout out to CNS Comics. How did that opportunity come about being able to work with those folks?
So, I was putting together an event for the comic book store, and I saw Wilson at an event. I went to go, like, some of my other friends were set up, like, vendors at this event. And I was like, oh, shoot, a Black comic book. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, I supported. I got the information, and I had an event where I invited Wilson to, like, come out and sell his stuff like a vendor. Like in my mind, I envision like a mini like convention type thing. I hosted it. I had a dancer, like almost like a belly dancer, but I had her dressed up as like Princess Leia. Mm-hmm. And she did some stuff with like some lightsabers, like her dance with like some like light up fans. I had this nerd band called D&D Sluggers. Like I said, I had Wilson from CNS Comics. Also had Brandon Blanks, who has his own comic, but now he's kind of under the CNS umbrella as well. I hosted, had some comedians, did like more nerdy material. It was like the 40th anniversary for our local comic book store. So I know that would have a good following. Even poetry, it was like music, poetry, dancing. And because it was just one of those things where I wanted to bring all aspects of like nerd, but especially blurred, because like everybody on the show wasn't Black, but it was definitely a Black presence, and put them together mm-hmm. in one room. So like to have that experience. Mm-hmm. No, so that's how we first linked up.
Word, you know, like, word. And now that you're officially working with CNS, what is the role in what capacity are you helping CNS with the comics?
Yeah, I'm gonna be going to different conventions with Wilson. I'll be speaking on some of the panels. It just being there, like helping to drum up business, and then on that side of it. And then CNS Comics, we have a lot of back end, so we offer a lot of services for people that I'm gonna be doing, like marketing things for them, like if you need animation, if you need graphics, that kind of thing like that. So I'm gonna help, I'm gonna start with comedy and music, you know, some of the people, my peers in that, seeing if they want to do, like, they're working on animating one of my bits, you know, and put that out there. Cause I was like, it'd be easier for me to pitch this if I have something that, you know, can show a real world. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be twofold. Like, and then eventually we'll be putting together CNS branded events or sponsored events as well. Like, we really want to, I'm not going to say their name, but there's like a comedian that Wilson really wants to bring down. So I'm going to see what we can do to make that happen and do like a CNS event, you know, to really get their name out there and some of the things that they do.
Word. Yeah, that's dope. And if you're listening to this, watching this, CNS Comics, we have the founder of the CNS on a podcast. That episode is actually exclusively on YouTube. So if you want to check that out, just head on over to the YouTube page. You can learn more about Wilson CNS, the comics that he's offering. He's got, I know Dark Fantasy Drop, the homie Spetty over there. They got some dope illustrators that are doing some great work over there. And like you said, man, you know, creators need content. And in this day and age, if you are a creator who does, I would say anything vocally, whether it be music, comedy, podcast, anything, you got to be able to put a visual to it to really make people feel where you're coming from. And I think it's dope to be able to have a resource like CNS to help bring some of your ideas to in a different light, like bring some animation, bring some color, just bring more to the story to help make it pop. So I think that's really good.
Yeah, stand out. I mean, it's so hard to stand out. There's so much out there these days. So, you know, do anything you can do to make your content step ahead of somebody else's. And then, I mean, they're different. Like, they got a style that'll help you stand out.
For sure. For sure. So, like, tell me, like, what do you personally enjoy most about being on stage doing a comedy set?
I mean, it has to be that instant gratification. You know what I mean? Like, just there and the hearing people laugh, like being able to just get up there and get that instant gratification, man. It's definitely like it's like a drug, man. You know, like, and I try my best not to get too high on it. You know,
I could imagine, like, and you go and you've gone now to a few places across the state. Do you mind just sharing some of the different venues that you've already been to and maybe will be go, you know, you might pop up again in the near future?
Yeah. So outside of Wilmington, I've done like I'm trying to think of the name. So it's in Roseville. It's a yoga spot. It's a yoga and winery. So I've done Roseville, Saigon Restaurant in Charlotte, Salty Hogs Needs Ferry. Hopefully I'll be doing Creedmoor soon in Raleigh. Man, why am I drawing such a blank? But yeah, so mostly like Raleigh, Charlotte area. I want to get into Greensboro and this. I've done Cary. I've done Bull City Cider in Cary. I've done Bull City Cider in Durham. I've done Hops in Raleigh. So shout out to Kyrie. Kyrie booked a lot of those shows for me in those areas. So.
Word. What's like the most intimidating crowd you've ever been around to deliver a show? Like, do you ever remember just being like, wow, this is a bit intense?
No, not really, man. Like, I know there's certain, because of certain crowds, I've kind of restructured some of my joke, because especially out of town, because I feel like I might've just started out too intense for them, or maybe too racial. So I was like, well, maybe I need to earn the right to kind of do that, like, before, so they know it's okay to laugh. Because I did a show in Wilmington that was Saturday, and then I had a show in Raleigh that Sunday, and it was North Raleigh. I did the same set, and it killed in Wilmington. And it wasn't like it was one of my shows. It was like somebody else's show, so those people didn't know me, but. Mm-hmm. I mean, they might have knew of me. And I was like, damn, you know, All so the comedians, my friends from Raleigh, all of them were great. But like listening back, I felt like I didn't get the laughs I wanted. It didn't hit off the way I wanted, like Wilmington did. And I felt like, maybe it's because I started off with some Juneteenth jokes, you know what I mean?
You mind sharing what you do? You mind sharing the joke?
No, I'm sure. So it's like, because I do different variations of it, but it's pretty much, I like celebrating I'm glad white people don't celebrate Juneteenth because I saw what y'all did to Cinco de Mayo.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And I go into a couple of examples, you know, like adding fried chicken and watermelon to your charcuterie boards. You know, get rid of your Doc Martens, get a fresh pair of Tim's. Mm-hmm. You know, Patagonia, start making dashikis, that kind of, you know, like that. So, and I was like, maybe that's just too, like I'm coming off too strong too early. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like I used to work, come a customer service tech support and work from home. So, you know, that's something a lot of people can work, relate to. So I started, like, I put that further back. And I started with that, you know what I mean? And then later on, I got a bit where I just talk about, I got a diverse group of friends. Some use Cash App, some use Venmo. People don't even realize that I'm talking about race when I say that. Because black people tend to use Cash App, white people tend to use Venmo.
That is a fact. That is a fact. Know?
But, you know, but even if you don't know that, it still works because it's still diverse because it's still two different systems. So it's like mm-hmm. one of those, but it's kind of, but if you do get that, then, you know, it's still like prepping you. So I'm still working up to like the Juneteenth stuff, mm-hmm. you know.
So would you say a lot of your comedy might have that close to the edge or edginess to it where you're teetering some of these sensitive subjects like race throughout your sets?
Not necessarily. Like, my comedy is an extension of me. It's not necessarily me. Like, sometimes it's just things that I might find funny or my experience. I'm what you call an observational comic. So it's things that I observe. I do touch a lot on race. You know what I mean? Like, it's like I like to come to the line. Like, I have a bit where I was like, all wine matters. And then I pause and I'll say, especially the white ones. You know, so it's like, I'm talking about wine, but I'm using things that might be, you know what I mean? Like, you know, because people will be like, all lives matter. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So it's like, it's not talking about race, but it is. You know, like, and, I might talk about, it just depends, you know, but a lot of it I dial back because I lose it. Like, I used to do a bit talking about a pool party. And it was like, it was part of my, like, I have a bit where I just talk about having a diverse group of friends. And then I used to talk, but I felt like white people just couldn't follow me on it. Like, I was like, it's pretty much talking about how white people, when they have a pool party, they get in the pool. And I would say, well, black people, we get around the pool. Like, and I was like, we get around the pool like y'all around that bar. You know, like, so but I felt like people, like I lost people.
Sneakers like, and socks, full outfit. Yeah. No intentions of getting wet. Pause.
That story came from a real, like, a friend of mine had a pool party. And I remember I was telling this girl, like, you know, she's like, oh, I don't have nothing to wear to a pool party. And in my mind, I was like, it's a party. You just wear regular clothes. You know, I mean, you might wear some sandals or some flip-flops. But when I got to the party, because I was late, you know, as we tend to be, they were actually in the pool. Mm. And then, like, one of my friends that was there, we just kind of went back. I was like, y'all are actually in the, like, I, in my mind, like, I didn't have, a, I didn't bring a bathing suit or anything. I'm just like, yeah, we going to be around the pool. Mm-hmm. But, mm-hmm. you know, and even though this was like it was a diverse group. Like, the person who throwing the party was black, but, you know, they hang around a good amount of white people. And I was like, oh, damn, y'all are actually in the pool. Like, it didn't even dawn on me. It was so funny to me that I didn't even dawn.
Didn't even dawn consider on me that
they might be in the pool.
Yeah. No, that's it. That is a fact. That is a fact. And it'll be hot as shit outside too. And you don't even think about getting in the pool. Like, that is a fact.
It's like, nah, man. I'm wearing my Jordans. I want y'all to see these Jordans that I'm wearing. I'm staying away from the pool because I don't want to get them wet.
Mm-hmm. And outside of it, so like, I appreciate you sharing some of the story. Like, and can you maybe speak about just like the reality of the grind of what you're doing? Because you're independent, you're getting it from the mud, you're starting like around your hometown locally, starting to spread throughout the state. But I'm sure it's not easy to, I mean, you're getting in your own vehicle. I know they're not flying you out private to these locations, traveling from, and you on the far east side of the state. Yeah. So, you know, that's at least what, 2.5-3 hours just to get to the triangle, let alone you've been out to Charlotte, out on the other side of what's going on. Like, can you speak to just how much of a grind it is to pursue what you're pursuing?
Oh man, yeah, it's like that first show in Youngsville. Far, like, I didn't make any money. You know what I mean? Like, so I drove the road. I drove out there. Luckily, shout out to my family. Shout out to my niece Brittany, my cousins. I stayed in Fuquay, which I thought Fuquay. My sister told me Fuquay was a lot closer to Youngsville than it was. I probably would have been better off staying with one of my cousins in either Durham or Knightsdale. So I drove the Fuquay, then still had to drive an hour to Youngsville, which I was told that it was close. But anyway, like, I did all that driving, you know, except luckily I got a strong, one thing we didn't really touch on, but luckily I got a strong merch game because I used to have a clothing line, you know. And so I made a couple of dollars, like a couple of friends came out, and they brought a couple shirts, but you know what I mean? Like, for like, you know, I didn't make any, there's been times where I've been to Durham, no money at all. You know what I mean? Like, you just, that's just a grind.
But do you always travel with merch when you go and you do your shows? Is that something you try to make sure you always have?
That's something that I'm trying to make sure of now. Like, I did the Durham show and I didn't, I wish I would have pulled up merch because I know I would have, in Durham, I know I would have made money. But I didn't. I didn't feel comfortable. Like, I don't know. It just, like, it was just a kind of weird vibe. So I didn't pull it. I didn't pull it out. But merch is very important. And I'm fortunate enough, like, my merch is my old clothing line. And my clothing line already, you know what I mean? They already have cachet. So I'm fortunate. It's like, I'm not trying to sell pictures. I'm not trying to sell shirts with my face on it or anything like that.
What's the name of the line?
County Lines Clothing, like the North Cat. So it's like, so it's a bunch of, it's all North Carolina stuff. So and you know, and I'm doing shows in North Carolina. So, I mean, it probably wouldn't work for me outside of North Carolina, but as far as in North Carolina, you know, most people are like, oh, I've seen that, you know, or known that, because I've had clothing in stores, like, back in the day, it was in Buddha's Belly in Raleigh, in Charlotte, it was in Manifest, but, and just in a couple of skate shops, and a couple of things, but I got the city shirts where it got all, like, the different nicknames, like, it says, like, Bull City, Chapel Thrill, G-Vegas, Raleighwood, that's probably the next shirt I'll have to re-release, you know, but right now I've been pushing, like, just the North Cag shirt, that has, like, the North Face style logo, which I stopped doing because I had a cease and desist way back in the day. So I stopped doing it. But, you know, it was like, I'm not selling shirts in stores. You know, like, back then I was like, I was always trying to put stuff in stores. But I mean, if you're going to show up at this brewery and try to catch me, good luck. You know what I mean?
Right, like, right. Out the trunk with it.
Yeah.
But that's dope. So, like, it just like taking a step back, like you said in the beginning, you kind of always wanted to work for yourself. But what I respect is that you actually put in some work along the way. A lot of folks, you know, wanting to work for yourself is one thing, but working for yourself is typically harder than working for other entities because you got to own everything from the product to the marketing to the operations to the payroll. Like, you got to manage the whole gamut. And and like the fact that even before you got to the comedy, you were already grinding in a way where it's almost kind of setting you up for this low key. It's like you're establishing relationships, getting used to the idea of live shows and performances, what it takes to put these things on. And then all of a sudden that leads to you putting on your own shows, bringing in other people, and now people bring you out for those shows. Like, you know, in a journey, you just never know what one thing is setting you up for. And who knew, say, that the clothing line would be something that you could then leverage as a comedian to help make some money when you step out and go do your performances, because the merch is a critical piece of making money when you're an artist. Like, you got to have something tangible to sell to people, you know. Yeah. It you got to have something that people can see you and purchase it. And do you sell it online, or is it just in person?
It's just in person. And that, that's true, because I try, you know, I mean, I always be thinking of marketing. So I did this, I placed third in a comedy competition. And I was like, yo, so I took that audio and I put it on like a little vinyl, like a record. And I was like, you know, I thought that would be a lot easier to sell than it was. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I thought that would be my merch, which is, it, I mean, I'm not mad about doing it, because it's something cool to have. But
you put it on a vinyl?
Yeah, it's actually called like a lathe, but pretty much it's like a record. It plays on a record player.
Mm-hmm. Is it one of those like, mini joints?
Yeah, like a EP. It's like, yeah, because it's like eight minutes long. Mm-hmm. But I did like 25 copies of it, and I'm selling that for $30. It's a lot easier to sell a $25 t-shirt or a $50 hoodie than it is a $25 to $30 record that people can't even
listen to it. They don't even have the machine, you know, or the thing to play it.
I definitely was like feeling myself, you know, because I thought everybody's going to want a piece of this. Is like a part, which some people are, like my friends, and you know, like they want that part of my history, or you know, whatever. But nobody there's only been a few people that didn't personally know me to buy it, you know what I mean? So that was kind of a little bit humbling, but you know, but
man, it's hard man, like, in anybody who's created anything, whether it be music, movies, I don't care what, paintings, it's hard to sell what you create. Like, I don't care what it is, like selling something that you create to somebody is not an easy thing to do. It is very difficult to get people to buy in or to purchase with their money something that you've created for multitude of reasons, but it's not an easy thing to do, for sure.
Yeah, especially it's like, I just heard them jokes, you know what I mean? Like, so like, I was like, but you don't want to take these jokes home with you, you know? And so, I mean, I did, but they are streaming. So it's like, I went, my little brother, who's also a hip hop artist, he helped his older brother out. So it's on all the different platforms, you know, to stream. So it's like, okay, well, you know, if you don't want to buy this, you can get it on your phone for free or whatever. So,
yeah, when we release this, make sure I know you sent me over some info, but Shoot me those links too, so I can include it for the listeners to check it out. Because I can put it right here in the description for those listening and watching. They just click and then boom, can get a feel for what you offer from a comedy perspective.
Definitely, yeah. So it's on all. I have a link. It'll take you to whatever you use to stream it. YouTube, Apple, Spotify, all that.
Word. And I know we're in the 2024. I don't want to like timestamp what we're doing, but just like, what can people expect from Louis T in 2024?
In 2024, man, like, just more kind of like, my goal is to, I mean, right now I'm kind of, I guess I'm almost, depending on the show, like on bigger shows, I'm a opener or a host. You know, like a lot of people get me to host their events. But I'm trying to go from the host to the feature. So I'm like the guy that, not the headliner, but I might be the person you might see right before the headliner on a bigger show. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that and just more shows, like more shows, trying to be consistent with the merch, trying to not be as, you know, like part of, like a lot of people don't do what I do. And I'm like, to me, it makes so much sense, but I guess everything is not common. Cause I was like, well, why aren't these other people doing it? So I was like, maybe I shouldn't be doing it. And it's like, I don't want to offend, especially if I'm like an opener or a host for like a national, you know, I've done a couple shows where, you know, I'm like hosting in for people, like a couple of people that's a lot of people that I work with are doing that Netflix is a joke festival. You know, like James Davis, Irene Tu, Ariel, like a lot of people. So they like, I was like, well, they're not doing it. You know, but, you know, I just did a show and I broke out the merch table. You know, like I made more money from merch than I did from doing four shows. Like we did two shows Friday, two shows Saturday. I didn't break it out Friday because I was like, maybe I shouldn't. I was like, right now I'm doing comedy pretty much full time. I'm like, I need this money. I can't be shy. Like I don't have a paycheck to fall back on. So I broke out the table and I made more money selling t-shirts and hoodies than I did, you know, performing. So,
no question. Yeah, man. I think you got to do it. I actually went and saw a comedy show at Raleigh Improv, pretty nice venue out in Cary. And it was Tony Rock. And he killed it. I ain't even gonna lie to you. Tony Rock was funny as shit. Tony Rock, you killed that shit. I gotta say, he killed it at Raleigh Improv. And he had an opener. He killed it too. But they had some merch available afterward too. It wasn't a lot, but it was still some available. And I know even at that level, like why would it, like I feel like it's just a necessary, you know, why wouldn't you offer that, right? Because people are out, especially at these venues, gonna have a few drinks, be feeling good, might be a little bit more inclined to say, you know what, that was dope, let me take one of these joints just to support because they like what you're doing. Like that's one of the things is there are a lot of folks out there who see what you're doing, like what you're doing, and will buy the merch, not even because they like the merch, just because they rock with you. And this is their opportunity to support what you're doing. So like create those opportunities for people to buy into you as a brand and everything you got going on.
Oh, that's so true. I know some people that like, I might not even have their size or the color they wanted, but like, oh, let me get it anyway. I'll give it to somebody. I just want to, you know, I want to support you. So, because I'm a likable guy. Why wouldn't you want to support me?
Yeah, man. Hey, if you listening, we're going to put Louis T info in the description so y'all can tap in, follow on social media, be able to link up with him and make sure you can listen wherever he's streaming. We're going to start to kind of close things out. And I want to just ask you here, like from a comedy standpoint, like you said, you're doing it full time now. You're doing it full time now. Like, what do you, if you have things your way, like what do you see as like the end game of what you're trying to create for yourself in this space? I know you mentioned trying to get to that feature, that headliner, but like, is this the thing you are trying to do full time for the rest, or is it setting you up for something else, like as another stepping stone? Like, what do you think this is gonna ultimately like lead you to as you keep putting in the work?
I would like to do, I guess what's called like corporate type gigs. Not necessarily the clubs. I'm not necessarily trying to be the headliner, but, especially specialized stuff. Like I would like to do conventions, like comic book conventions where I can talk about nerdy stuff or even businesses, like, you know. So right now I'm trying to, as I build my set to be the feature, a lot of it is building where I do talk about working from home or doing customer service material. So like, so I'll, you know, maybe like have a corporate bring me to their Christmas party or their corporate party and I entertain them. So I just come do my thing for that and kind of pretty much bounce or whatever, or go to a Comic-Con or comic type convention or blurred or nerd type convention and perform for that, where I can talk about being a low level nerd and talk about Dungeons and Dragons and that kind of stuff. And they actually get those references.
Word. is there anything that you want to just leave with the audience here? I mean, like, we've already dropped some jewels, but in terms of like anything, takeaways, where if the listeners are watching or if the viewers are watching, the listeners are listening, is there anything that you hope that folks take away from hearing you here today?
Hey, man, like, you can do it. Like, don't talk about it. Be about it. Like, there's a lot of people that say, oh man, I want to do comedy, but, you know, like, go to a, like, I wish I would have got on this journey sooner. Like I said before, out around Nut Street when comedy was like, and I wish I would have embraced it sooner. Like, go, you know, if you want to do it, just do it. Go to an open mic. At least if you don't even perform, just go check it out, you know. Mm-hmm. So, or whatever your version of that is, like, it's no time like today. You're not getting younger, so embrace your dreams, and don't be afraid to invest in yourself.
1,000%, yo, man. I respect it, man. I respect anybody who's willing to do what you just said, invest in yourself, and then actually take that step to actually do what we say we want to do. So shout out to Louis T. This is the G podcast, where we focus on family, friends, finances, freedom, and our future, and everything else. This is the G podcast. I greatly appreciate y'all listening. Make sure you hit that subscribe button, follow on your favorite platform. We are out of here.